This past week, the Bush administration reiterated its stance on the preemptive use of military force against weapons of mass destruction. In a strategy paper, it says the United States will respond with overwhelming force using all options if facing an imminent threat. Senior administration figures acknowledge these options include nuclear weapons. The Pentagon has also reportedly been exploring the use of so-called low-yield nuclear devices. Robert J. Lifton is visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the author of several books on Hiroshima and mass violence. We asked him if he thinks the U.S. has moved the bar on the use of nuclear weapons.
There's no doubt that the United States has lowered the bar on the use of nuclear weapons. It's made that clear in a series of policy statements, so that although this recent statement sounds only like some form of deterrence put aggressively, it's what the administration calls offensive deterrence, and it has a more belligerent dimension. But overall, it's part of a general policy of usability in relation to nuclear weapons, treating them as any weapon and making quite clear that they're usable, and even seeking new creative approaches to nuclear weapons, if that's the term, in order to make them more usable.
Now, for decades, the United States doctrine was that there would be no first strike when it came to atomic weapons. There's talk now that this could be preemptive. How did we change positions? Has this been rapid or has this been evolving?
It's been both. I mean, it has evolved, but it also, this is a rather revolutionary shift. We haven't been in the past that clear that we wouldn't be capable of first use, because we have consistently refused an anti-first use pledge. All presidents during the nuclear age have had a kind of uneasy duality in relation to nuclear weapons. On the one hand, they've said, these are extraordinary weapons. They can never be used. They're too destructive. They're too inhumane. On the other hand, they were part of policies that projected their use and at times spoke of their use. So every president had that draconian ambivalence toward the weapons. This administration seems to have almost no ambivalence. It's made quite clear in a number of statements and documents that it considers them usable.
Is this rhetoric important?
The rhetoric has very great importance. It's true that the rhetoric can sometimes have threat and bluff, and there is an element of threat and potential bluff in all deterrence statements, including the one just recently. But rhetoric has great importance because it reflects the view of the administration toward the weapons, and it prepares the world for what the rhetoric is indicating.
Understanding that any American president would have to present a strong image to the world and a united one, why would we want to do anything that sort of encourages the destructive mentality of some of the terrorism that we're seeing in the world? Is there a kind of compensatory dynamic that takes place?
Well, there is. And I think that we sometimes close ourselves, numb ourselves to the impact on the world of what we're doing. And a large part of this is our embrace of ourselves as the world's only superpower. That becomes enormously important because a superpower cannot be vulnerable, and superpower status depends upon nuclear dominance. Therefore, our commitment to remaining the only superpower who cannot be in any way threatened or in any way contested militarily, this we've said in our written statements and spoken doctrine. So our relationship to being a superpower, or to what I call the superpower syndrome, really locks us in to this belligerent kind of rhetoric and belligerent behavior.
Looking at U.S. security doctrines and some of the responses they found and some of the attacks on the U.S. and other Western allies, let me say you could perhaps characterize it as the Western powers and the United States feeling vulnerable and some of the opponents of the United States talking about feeling oppressed. Is there something apocalyptic in both characterizations?
I think there is an apocalyptic dimension, certainly very clearly and overtly, to bin Laden and Islamist terrorism. But there's an apocalyptic dimension that may be less visible to our own behavior, in which we see ourselves as entitled to lash out and carry out what's called offensive deterrence, and it can include so-called preemptive or preventive war, and this we feel to be a sense of entitlement. I think that our apocalyptic tendencies have intensified since 9/11, because 9/11 brought home to us a sudden and shocking and intolerable vulnerability, which we've, in one sense, compensated for by aggressive embrace of ourselves as a superpower and by a policy that really seeks world domination. I don't think we want to be an empire in the traditional sense, but we do want to control important events in the world. We want to control history. And that has an omnipotent and apocalyptic enterprise that is really harmful and is bound to be not only destructive to the world, but destructive to ourselves.
A sobering conversation, Dr. Lifton. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert J. Lifton is visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author most recently of Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism, also Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial.